Welcome to Why Wonders Why, a companion podcast to Smart Enough to Know Better. This episode is titled Story Time! You may know Smart Enough to Know Better as the Lamb House of science and the laughing gas of comedy and that weird bath sludge of ignorance. But Greg and Dan also write. And I thought it'd be really fun to put some of these stories in the podcast and let you enjoy them. First off the rank has already been on the podcast a couple of years ago. It was written by me, Gregoire, and performed by Natalie Bohensky, and is called Cuckoo.
Anna sat back heavily into her home office chair, perplexed at the results she was reading from her latest batch of tests. After working for 15 years as a research pediatrician, she thought she had seen it all, but the report sitting on her desk confused and worried her. It was going to throw the medical world upside down. Unequivocally, it showed that monozygotic twins should not happen. Human identical twins couldn't exist. She shook her head slowly, refusing to accept the words written on the pages in front of her. The cellular tests couldn't be right, even though she had had them done and redone over and over to make sure. It couldn't be true. She had worked with hundreds of identical twins over the years. It would be like saying the sky wasn't blue or water wasn't wet. It was preposterous. And then there was the small matter of her own six-month-old daughters sleeping in the room next to her study. Anna listened to Rose and Gabby through the baby monitor as they murmured softly in their sleep. Her daughters were more real than anything else she had experienced in her life. She wouldn't even have given this nonsense the time of day except for the email sent to her by a good friend and colleague. Martin's email simply said, "Twins not possible. If a zygote divides, the initial telomeres are not copied to the secondary. Without telomeres, the cells self-destruct. It's so easily found. How have we not discovered this before? I don't want to believe it. What about my boys? I'm sorry." Martin was found slumped over his laptop by his wife, who was left to care for their twin sons by herself. His cause of death was deemed to be a massive hemorrhagic stroke. At first, Anna ignored the email. It sounded like the confused ramblings of a person pushed to the brink, and Martin had always been highly strung. But the idea kept popping back into her head. If any part of what Martin was saying was true, it would be a groundbreaking discovery. Anna quietly started working on the issue on her own time, well aware if anybody found out she was working on something so patently stupid, it could derail her career. Within a couple of months, she had her answer, and now it was sitting on her desk, taunting her with its implications. "A second embryo cannot form from cellular division," she marvelled aloud. "Without the telomeres being copied, the potential twin self-destructs almost instantly." Anna kept trying to get her brain around the implications of this work. It could lead to a Nobel Prize. But a darker thought clouded her mind. "Martin was right," she said to the air. "Why has this not been found before? It's not that hard to find if you just look." She faltered as the darkest ramification finally coalesced in her thoughts. If twins aren't possible, then how are there twins? The baby monitor squawked loudly, making her jump. Under the interference hissing from the speaker, she thought she could hear chuckling. Anna felt her skin go cold as she slowly rose from her chair. Was someone else in her daughter's room? She moved carefully into the hallway and then to the door of the nursery. Listening at the door, she couldn't hear a thing, so she carefully opened it, bit by bit. She could see Gabby sleeping in her cot, her innocent face peaceful. But as Anna opened the door further, she saw Rose staring directly at her. Anna walked slowly to the crib, a feeling of dread growing as her daughter stared at her unblinkingly. Rose made an inhuman chuckling sound, much too deep for an infant her size, and Anna staggered backwards from the cot, shocked and fearful. Her daughter pointed at her, pudgy arms and fingers distorting, twisting and stretching slowly in her direction as she uttered her first words. "Cuckoo." Cuckoo, cuckoo.
Even though I like to think I write science fiction stories, really, I write what an old person might call a Twilight Zone episode and young people might call creepypasta. I have a habit of going into that macabre, gothic-y weirdness, which I don't really like. And when I was asked about where did this story come from, like what was the idea, and I went, well, obviously I think that identical twins are creepy and weird and strange, and I honestly do. They're just so weird. The only thing weirder than identical twins in my mind, anything I find creepier, are left-handed people and redheads. So if you're a left-handed, red-headed, identical twin, just oof, terrifying. You're like my version of clowns. It's very, very, very scary. All right, moving on to the second story. This is an original piece written by Dan Beeston and performed by Dan Beeston and Gregoire. It's called Radio.
Hello? Come in. Anyone? If you can hear me, I'm Dan. I'm from planet Earth. We need your help. We were supposed to be chasing ungulates on the plains of the savannah, but our brains, they got too big, too quickly. The rats and the birds would just look out for themselves, but we started to care. Our weakest members were lifted up. We were a rising tide, and every boat came with us. We're now the dominant form of life on this planet, and we got there by caring for each other. And the more we cared, the better we got at knowing what each other wanted. We adapted mental tools that allowed us to share our thoughts, but something went wrong. Now we can spread bad ideas so fast, so fast. But we're still too dumb to question them. We still communicate using the same set of emotions that helped us turn deer into meat. But the concepts we're trying to communicate are so complex. We're all getting angry and confused. We're heating up our air and our oceans. It needs to stop, but we can't seem to convince ourselves to do it. We're making up stories and then getting angry when some of us make up conflicting stories. We're slowly destroying ourselves. We have resources. Heaps of water, nitrogen, gold, even some lithium. Please, if anyone's out there, if you can hear me, please, come and destroy us. Really, get it over with quickly, like a band-aid, real fast.
Hey, who are you?
Just wipe us out. We are really fragile.
You're not allowed to be touching that.
Oh, or save us. I guess that's an option too. What did you do?
Does anyone else get the idea that Dan might be in a very nihilistic mood after listening to that? Good little story, though. And now we move on to the third story of the podcast. A couple of weeks ago, I put the call out to our listeners saying, hey, if you wanted to be involved and write some short stories for the podcast, feel free, and I will sort of go through them, and I'll pick the ones I like, and we'll put them on the podcast. And I got some really interesting stuff sent me. It was actually really exciting to read it. And I realized I'd made a big mistake. You see, words mean things. So when I said short story, what I meant was what Dan and I do, these short, sharp sketches, these weird little things. But I found out that's not a short story. A short story is, you know, 5,000 words, 10,000 words, 20,000 words, as in a lot of words. What Dan and I do are normally what you'd call flash fiction, sort of 1,000 words or less, or maybe even micro fictions, which are 300 words or so. So, whoops, people started sending me really long stories, much longer than I was expecting, and I wasn't too sure what to do. But I've decided I'm going to display one of them here. This is a great little story written for this very podcast by Eloise Dundas Taylor. Now, Eloise, you may have heard her voice before. She's one of the people I interview for the check-in segments of the podcast, where we talk to people around the world about their COVID experience. And she has written this great story.
Crime and Crime Again, written and performed by Eloise Dundas Taylor. Gideon checked the clock again for what felt like the millionth time. It was almost time for the next jump. 30, 29, 28. The nervous energy was already building inside him. He tried to steady his breathing. Slowly, in and out, he told himself. 25, 24, 23. He fumbled nervously with his wristband, tightening it one last time. Why was he so edgy? He'd completed the jump successfully hundreds of times before. Well, technically 137. Why was the 138th suddenly so nerve-wracking? 19, 18, 17. Gideon's hands strayed to the secret inside pocket of his jacket, where he kept his lucky coin, the first he'd ever lifted. The familiar, smooth face of the coin calmed him as he rubbed it gently between his thumb and forefinger. 13, 12, 11. Time to prepare himself. He crouched down in his usual ready position, hand hovering over the dial pad on his wristband. 7, 6, 5. He drew in a long, deep breath and tensed his body. 3, 2, 1. He jammed his finger down on the launch button, a little harder than necessary. The time vortex opened around him, and he felt his body being sucked into the event horizon. A feeling of weightlessness, followed by an intense falling sensation, overwhelmed his senses as he felt his body hurtle through the void. As the rushing sound roared around his ears, he shut his eyes tightly, still not daring to look at the infinity around him. He remembered to breathe out in one slow, continuous breath. Horrible images of what happens to jumpers who forget breath control when travelling through the void came unbidden into his mind. Very unpleasant, wet, inside-out images. Slow and steady, he reminded himself as his breath seeped between his lips. He began to feel the atmosphere, if you could call it that, change around him. Almost there. Then, in the next instant, he landed in what he knew was the right moment. Breathing in and out heavily, he stood up, then immediately crouched back down again, just as he saw himself begin to turn around. He'd almost forgotten how, in his previous jump, he thought he heard something behind him and had turned to look. How long had Gideon looked behind himself before he turned away again? He was sure it had only been a few moments. Better just count to five to be sure. When he was positive the coast was clear, Gideon popped his head back up and surveyed where he needed to go next to not be seen by the security cameras or his previous selves. I really need to start writing this shit down, he thought to himself. It was getting harder to keep all the versions of himself straight in his head. It had been such a simple idea at first. Progressively break into a bank vault using time jumps to the same moment over and over again. If he got stuck at any point, he could create a diversion with security so that a future version of himself could figure out the problem, then jump back to continue cracking the safe. He'd already practiced on a dozen small-town banks, making himself a tidy sum in the process. But for those heists, he only ever needed a handful of jumps to succeed. This time, however, he was fast realizing he may have bitten off more than he could chew. Equipped with the finest security measures this side of the galaxy, breaking into the Zenith Galactic Financial Bank had been deemed impossible. Gideon, however, merely saw it as a challenge to be conquered. Of course, one couldn't merely time jump inside the vault itself. Obviously, the bank would have thought of such things, putting time locks in place surrounding the vault area. No, what this job needed was some good old-fashioned safe-cracking. Now Gideon was beginning to realize just how dumb this idea actually was. The first 37 jumps alone were needed to run defense on scrambling the security teams, disabling the alarm systems, and unlocking all necessary entrances. The rest had been meticulously chipping away at the multi-layered coding on the safe combination. but the number of jumps this had taken was already way past the safe critical juncture mark, especially considering he wasn't that experienced in time jumping. Then again, the nature of time jumping was so unpredictable that it was hard to know exactly where critical juncture would occur. It was different for every jump. Sometimes it could be hundreds, other times they could occur with as little as four. One thing Gideon knew was that the bigger the number of jumps, the bigger the bang. The most he'd ever heard of was 2,698 individual jumps to one point in time. It was also the reason why New Paris was off limits. And he was sure that they were at least writing shit down. In any case, jump 137 was positive there was only one more code to input, and this time he came armed with his secret weapon. This had better work, Gideon thought, as he once again absent-mindedly stroked the lucky coin in his pocket. He was finding it more and more difficult to locate safe arrival zones. The Zenith had only so many entry points, and they were starting to get more than a little crowded. Annoyingly, even though he had only one additional sequence left to enter, he had to jump further and further from the vault room in order to avoid past versions of himself and the security teams. This jump actually landed him outside of the building. Staying low, he scurried across the courtyard and positioned himself behind a large marble column adjacent to the main entry. He guessed he had roughly 4 minutes to get back into the building, make his way up to the vault room, and find a safe place to return to Origin. He watched himself appear in front of the doors, enter the combination to unlock the entrance, and vanish, just as a different past self ran full speed behind him, followed closely by three security guards, who looked stunned when their cornered suspect vanished before their eyes. Gideon took a moment to smile smugly at the guard's confusion, then rushed through the now unlocked and unguarded front doors and dived behind the large reception desk. The building itself was circular in design, with a large void extending upwards through the middle. Dozens of balconies faced away from hundreds of doors, all leading to different kinds of treasures. The one that Gideon wanted, however, was up on level 7. He stared upwards, picking his next path. He waited as various security drones flew around the atrium and watched as jumps 17 through 25 picked them off one by one. Jump 28 suddenly appeared and ran out through the front doors in order to lead the returning security guards in the opposite direction they'd just come in. And jump 30 embarrassingly wasted an entire jump by accidentally landing in the foyer's large decorative koi pond. Gideon put his head in his hands and sighed as he watched himself frantically search his pockets for his lucky coin. He found it at the bottom of the pond and grabbed it right before returning to Origin to dry off and try again. What is it with large banks and their unnecessary decorative foyer koi ponds anyway? Finally, he picked his moment. He slipped out from behind the reception desk a mere second before jump 32 dove into the same spot, hitting the dial pad, taking them back to Origin. Gideon barrel-rolled across the floor, popping up back-to-back with jump 37, turning together in an unseen fluid motion, then hurled himself behind a conspicuously placed pot plant. He observed 37 return to Origin, just as jump 41 popped into his place. "Well, that was really stupid," he groaned to himself, not realizing just how close together he had made those jumps. Two coinciding jumps practically on top of each other may be incredibly dangerous, but what worried him more was this kind of activity was bound to have caught the attention of the Criminal Time Jump Prevention Squad. He had really hoped he wouldn't run into those guys. He snorted at the thought of the name. Why did government bureaucrats always come up with the most boring and dullest names possible for their departments? They may as well have called themselves the Don't Do Bad Time Travel Crimes Team. Whatever the name, he now figured he had even less time to make it up to the vault, crack that code and make it out again. Okay, focus. No need to panic. Now, what happens next? Gideon glanced over enviously to the elevator doors. No, he told himself, it's too risky. They were the obvious way in and out, and he knew he had to leave them for only either the direst of circumstances or his final retreat. He'd have to make it upwards the hard way. He'd come prepared this time and brought out his grappling gun. He shot it directly at Balcony 7 and hit the retracting button. He zoomed upwards at great speed and landed on the outside edge of the balcony. He kept his head down as Jump 56 sprinted past on the other side, then hoisted himself over the rail in one smooth jump. Landing as quietly as possible, he placed himself just slightly round the corner of the door. He needed to time this perfectly and was waiting for the exact moment. He spent at least 2 precious minutes watching as dozens of versions of himself came tumbling out of the door one after the other at almost perfect intervals. His hands strayed to his lucky coin once again, gripping it in order to stop his pulsing adrenaline. Almost there. You can do this. Then came the pause he was looking for. He counted to 3, curled himself into a tight ball, and rolled through the entrance. Jump 137 instinctively launched himself over the object coming through the doorway. He didn't look back to see what it had been, knowing full well what would happen if he did. Instead, he just kept running towards the corridor. Gideon rolled back up onto his feet and stood up, striding over to the vault control panel with an almost cocky air about him. Still gripping his lucky coin, he pulled it from his pocket, his secret weapon. The nickel coating made the object the perfect conductor after he affixed the microscopic nanochip to one side. This little lucky charm contained the data required to break the last security code and scramble the rest of the security protocols. Gideon placed the coin onto the scanner pad and started keying in the data he had reconned from previous jumps. Finally came the moment, and in giddy anticipation, Gideon hit the enter key. Soon the vault would open and a galaxy's worth of virtual data would be his to control. Rich beyond his wildest dreams was an understatement. With this kind of wealth and information, Gideon would have absolute power. Nothing happened. Gideon hit the enter key again. Still nothing happened. Perhaps the coin's nanochip hadn't scanned properly. He shifted the coin back and forth on the scan pad slightly, then hit the enter key a third time. Access denied flashed across the screen in front of him. What? No, this can't be happening. It had to work. Gideon heard a loud crash and realized the main entrance doors had burst open. His time had run out. Gideon grabbed his coin, then sprinted out of the vault and back through the door towards the elevator, his last means of escape. But it was too late. They'd already disabled the electronics. There was only one thing for it now. Taking a deep breath, Gideon hurled himself over the balcony and into the empty air. His re-entry to Origin was going to be painful, but at least he'd escaped. As he felt himself begin to fall, he hit the launch button on his teleporter's dial pad, only to be hit in the gut with a rubber bullet just as the time vortex opened around him. The wind was completely knocked out of him as he began to traverse through the void. Oh shit, oh no! He fought the overwhelming urge to gasp in, and instead forced himself to expel what little air he had left in his lungs. This is it, I'm Cactus, he thought as he pressed his diaphragm down harder. By some miracle, he landed back in his Origin Point hideout, curled up clutching his stomach, racked with excruciating pain and gasping noisily in and out. As the pounding in Gideon's chest began to subside, he gingerly rolled onto his back. He immediately regretted this, not because it caused any greater amount of pain than he was already experiencing. Rather, it was because he now stared up into the face of Vasira Twine, Chief Inspector of the Criminal Time Jump Prevention Squad. "Well, you certainly caused a bit of a mess, didn't you?" Vasira asked wryly. "How are you, Gideon? Can I get you anything? A glass of water, perhaps? A pillow?" The smug smile crept across her face as she spoke her feigned concern. "Yes, thanks," Gideon wheezed out. "Oh, get up," Vasira grabbed the front of Gideon's shirt, hurling him reluctantly onto his feet. She spun him round, roughly unstrapping the temporal pad from his wrist before clapping a pair of handcuffs around them instead. She pocketed the pad, then flipped open her wrist communicator. "Central Command, I have him. Requesting extraction." A large portal opened in front of them. Large portals controlled and run by the central government were much more stable and far easier to travel through compared to the risky voids created with portable wrist pads, so at least Gideon didn't have to worry about being turned inside out on this trip. Travel occurred in an instant, so before he could blink, he was once more standing inside the bank foyer. Only this time, there were hundreds of agents congregating all through the main atrium and up the various levels.
bagging evidence, interviewing security guards, and carrying the broken pieces of the downed security drones. Some were even dredging the little koi pond in the main foyer. Gideon once again allowed himself a little smirk. All this trouble for little old me, he thought. Viscera, sensing Gideon's enjoyment, shoved him ahead of her a little harder than necessary, marching him over to a group of agents. They were gathered around a man with an important air about himself. He was wearing a grey tailored suit and reading from an electronic surface. He looked up and smiled broadly as the two approached. "Director," Viscera saluted. "Ah, Inspector, I see you've apprehended our little troublemaker." Still smiling, the director looked down at Gideon and gave him a small wink. Gideon was already annoyed with this guy's overtly overjoyed attitude, but felt the condescension really wasn't necessary. "Keep cool, Gideon. It's time to talk your way out of this one." "Look, I don't know what you're talking about. You got the wrong guy." Gideon turned on his most charming smile. Viscera took the electronic surface from the director and held it up for Gideon to see. "Oh yeah, how do you explain this then?" She scrolled through dozens of still images taken from the security cameras, some showing him aiming what looked like a small gun directly into the center of the frame. "Clones?" Gideon suggested after a moment's pause. Viscera gave him a withering look. "You can't just take out the drones, dummy. You need to delete the footage too." Gideon's smile dropped. He had literally not considered that. He'd assumed once the uplink was destroyed, the footage would disappear too. How was he supposed to know that's not how security drones work? "I'm not a dummy," he mumbled, trying desperately to stop his face from flushing red. Viscera turned to one of the agents. "Sergeant, search him." She pushed Gideon slightly towards the agent. The director interjected. "Come now, Viscera, is that really necessary?" "Sir, he had a laser pistol," Viscera gestured with the surface, referring to the gun in the photos and currently hidden beneath Gideon's jacket. He hadn't intended to use it on anyone, just to take down the security drones. The director sighed. "Well, at least uncuff him." Viscera rolled her eyes before unlocking the cuffs. Gideon rubbed his wrists as the agent searched him. The laser pistol, grappling hook, and a compact lockpick set were all found and handed over to Viscera. Then the agent felt inside Gideon's pockets and took out his lucky coin. "Hey, no, wait, that's actually mine!" Viscera sensed Gideon's panic and took the coin for a closer inspection. She turned it over a few times, examining it closely. "And what's so special about some lousy nickel?" Gideon tried not to give anything away. "It's just my lucky coin is all." He tried not to blink as he stared hard at Viscera. Taking a moment to decide whether she wanted to take this any further, Viscera merely put the coin in her top jacket pocket and pressed on. Relief washed over Gideon and he let out a small breath. "There you are, Inspector, just a harmless coin." Viscera ignored the director and pressed on. "Gideon Calestro, you're hereby charged with 138 counts of break and enter, 138 counts of attempted theft, and 138 counts of illegal use of a temporal time divergence pad. Is there anything you have to say for yourself?" Gideon had been waiting for this moment and smugly replied, "Well, technically it was multiple attempts of the same crime, so really it should just be the one count? I read about it. It's called double jeopardy." He felt very pleased with himself. "Don't pull that crap. That's not how double jeopardy works, and you know it." "Actually, I think you'll find that it does." The crisp voice of a woman cut through the general din. Striding towards the group was an extremely confident-looking woman wearing a pale blue business suit and a very determined expression on her face. The director turned and his face lit up. "Evandra, so nice to see you. I didn't realise young Mr. Calestro was so well connected."
"Save the pleasantries, Director Maddock. I must insist that you release my client at once."
Viscera looked confused.
"Sorry, who is this exactly?"
Evandra turned to Viscera, handing her a business card.
"Evandra Henderson, space lawyer."
Viscera glanced over the card briefly, then handed it back to Evandra. "You know, you can just say lawyer. You don't have to stick space in front of it." Evandra ignored the sarcasm and placed the card back inside her purse.
"You shouldn't have even started questioning my client without a lawyer present. He's a minor, after all."
"I'd hardly call 17 a minor," Viscera spat back.
Gideon didn't know whether to feel grateful or embarrassed.
Be that as it may, my client is quite correct in saying that there should only be one count. One location, one attempt, one person. What should it matter if time travel is involved?
That is liberal misinterpretation of the law, and you know it, Basira glared at Gideon.
Also, how exactly did she know to come here? When did you even get the chance to call her?
My firm will receive a request for representation tomorrow morning. I'm here to advise you that you are to allow him to place said call at the appropriate time. After all, we don't want to compromise the time stream, do we?
Now it was Evandra's turn to look pleased. Visira, on the other hand, looked ropeable.
What? You can travel using time variation devices? And where exactly did you get access to that kind of technology?
Let's just say I have friends in high places.
Evandra gave Director Maddock a sideways glance, who shifted uncomfortably about.
Director, this is highly irregular. These are civilians, and we've already seen what happens when deregulated tech falls into the wrong hands,
Visira gestured at Gideon.
Director Maddock attempted to wave the concern away.
Don't worry, Inspector. The department heads have long ago signed off on this kind of arrangement.
Well, then I'd appreciate it if I could be kept in the loop, Visira said.
As the argument continued, Gideon looked around and noticed an agent approaching the group.
Inspector, we found this in the pond. I think you might want to take a look at it.
She handed a small coin over to Visira.
Another coin? What's so special about this one?
Our instruments were picking up some out-of-time variations near the pond. We scanned the evidence gathered and this came back positive for nanotechnology.
Visira glared at Gideon. I guess we'll have to add possession of illicit materials to the list as well.
For a moment, Gideon was confused. How could a coin from the pond have nanotech? Then in his mind he flashed back to Jump 30, the fall in the pond, and a sick, cold feeling began creeping into the pit of his stomach. Just as Evandra was about to protest on Gideon's behalf, Visira suddenly cried out in pain, grabbing at her chest. She dropped the coin to the ground and began to rip at her top jacket pocket. Director Maddock moved in to assist, but she held up an arm to keep him at bay. Visira managed to pull the coin she had confiscated from Gideon earlier out of her pocket. She looked from it to the coin on the ground. She placed the coin she was holding onto a scanner pad and quickly keyed in a few numbers. Her eyes widened, then looked up accusingly at Gideon.
"Where on the timeline is this coin from?"
she demanded, holding out the coin. All eyes were now on Gideon. The colour had drained from his face.
"Where, Gideon?"
Gideon turned and looked at the pond. A memory flashed. His dad was taking him to the bank. The largest bank in the solar system. So many opportunities and programs and support packages. They were bound to be eligible for one of them. Gideon sat by the pond as his dad talked with an important-looking man. He watched the koi swim round when something shiny caught his eye. He looked around again. His dad looked sad, like he was about to cry. He'd never seen his father cry before. Gideon looked back at the pond and came to a decision. He glanced around to make sure no one was watching and grabbed the coin. He put it in his pocket. Then a moment later, his dad came and took his hand and they left the bank. He didn't realize at the time what had happened, nor in the months to come understand why they couldn't live in their home anymore. But as he played with his lucky coin, he vowed he would make more. Then maybe his dad wouldn't cry anymore. The memory faded, and Gideon turned back to Visira.
Here, he stammered. The coin is from here. In a few weeks, I take it when I'm 10 years old.
Visira dropped her arm down, stunned.
You moved this coin across your timeline. You've moved across your own timeline. Do you have any idea what kind of paradox you've caused?
Director Maddock got in his communicator and called in for all available units to converge on the Zenith for assistance, his jovial air completely gone. Evandra looked slightly panicked and left to make a phone call to her firm. But at that moment, there was a large tremor that rocked the ground. For a moment, everyone stopped to assess the situation. Then suddenly all the agents were abuzz, talking and taking action at once. Gideon looked at Visira and knew what he needed to do. In the commotion, he charged at her, knocking her off her feet as he grabbed the coin, then sprinted in the direction of the koi pond. He jumped into the centre and triumphantly dropped the coin in. Everyone seemed to breathe a sigh of relief. Then, flashing his most devilish smile, Gideon slowly and deliberately waved his other hand, which was holding his temporal wrist pad that he'd expertly lifted off of Vasira when he had run into her. As he hit the launch button, he looked up and thought how it seemed that the world had slowed down. Vasira, Evandra, and even Director Matic were all trying to run towards him, but looked as if they were wading through water, each with an expression of horror on their faces. It was only as the time vortex opened around him that Gideon realized that time hadn't just seemed to slow down, it had slowed down. Terror gripped Gideon as he travelled once more through the void at the sudden realization that he hadn't reset his jump coordinates. He landed back outside the bank, only this time staring face to face with jump 138. They looked at each other for a moment in stunned silence, but before either could open their mouths to scream, the critical juncture explosion ripped through the complex. After the dust had settled, all that could be found was a small nickel coin embedded in the crater where the Zenith Galactic Financial Bank once stood.
I love a good time travel story. And by good, I mean a time travel story that sets up its rules, keeps to the rules, and makes a really great narrative. And Eloise really hit that on the head. I've listened to this quite a few times, trying to find the logical inconsistencies when it falls down, and I don't think it does. I think it's really, really good. So thank you, Eloise, for that one. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to keep this episode quite short. We'll come back with new episodes in a couple of months to show off the other short stories, as in 5,000 to 10,000 word stories, that people have actually submitted for us. Oh my goodness, that was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed this different type of Wow Wonders Why. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, go back into the world. And remember, to be kind is to be brave. So try and be brave over the next couple of weeks and be as kind as possible. Bye.